Pour some sugar on me. It's the Infuse Show brought to you by Terrapin Select. Terrapin Select CBD for all your health and wellness needs. Shop terrapinselect.com, as well as our fake sponsor, Meh Edibles. They're not that great. They're not that bad. They're meh. Let's do the show. Guys, today back with me here in Delaware, Francesca and Mike, welcome back. It's great to see you.
Always good to be seen.
Good to be here.
Oh, guys, look, we're all really excited today. You guys are it's almost like going home. You guys know our today's guest, but I've got to introduce our audience to today's guest. He is an actor. He is a celebrated, best-selling New York Times and Wall Street Journal author of 9 books, including the celebrated Book Yourself Solid, as well as the CEO and co-founder of Heroic Public Speaking right there in Lambertville, which you guys are both graduates of.
You got that right. Got it.
Please join me in welcoming Mr. Michael Poor to the Infuse Show. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, I just should clarify. I'm an actor insofar as that all human beings are actors to some degree. I was a professional actor about 30 years ago. So I haven't done that in a long time.
Like yesterday.
Calls, I'm happy to go. But other than that.
No, Michael, anybody with an IMDb page, brother. I looked at it. I was impressed. I love actors.
You saw my pictures with hair?
Yeah. And you know, we have some Sex and the City fans here too. And we're like, oh my God, he was on Sex and the City. So everybody's excited about this one. Listen, I know our audience and some of the guests that we've had on, Michael, are really interested in the topic today. Because a lot of people that we talk to or a lot of people that listen to us all have cannabis stories to tell. It's a matter of, you know, how effective they can be while telling those stories. So you're doing us a tremendous service joining us here today on the show. And I just want to repeat my thanks to start us out.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I am doing a tremendous service.
Yeah.
Right now. Actually, that's yet to be determined. We'll have to see how it goes.
Okay. I have a good feeling, though, that you might know just a little bit about the topic of communication.
I'll take the over on that. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, Michael and I and Mike all know each other because Mike and I attended Heroic Public Speaking, which is, you know, just the most incredible public speaking training, world class, that is, fortunately for us, only an hour and a half away. And been through many sessions and learned so much. And when we were talking about bringing Michael on, it made so much sense because there are so many ways to communicate, so many things to communicate in the cannabis community. And there is so much room for growth with that. And it's important. It's important stuff that we're talking about because, you know, just the very first thing that I wanted to cover is that there are people that are in cannabis because they have this personal connection to the plant. And when they have that personal connection, they have a very usually personal story. It is just one of our most recent guests, Nikki Lawley, who is a pediatric nurse, suffered a traumatic brain injury and was really on the brink of the edge and saved herself by discovering cannabis. And she had this incredible story. And I thought, that's the kind of thing that changes hearts and minds, that ends the stigma of cannabis, which has done so much damage to people and to this country. And so we want to help people, first and foremost, help people tell better stories, help those stories that they have, those connections with the plant, to become connections with people, to change lives and to change how we're viewing this plant. I think, you know, we're there, but we can be better. We can go beyond where we are. And so, Michael, I think the first question for you is, when we're talking about communication and we're telling these personal stories, what exactly is it that we can do to help those stories become transformational for our audience, whether that's a podcast, a live audience, a one-on-one story? I mean, that's what you've done for the coaching with me and Mike and certainly every other Heroic Public Speaking person. So I'd love to hear what you have to say about it.
Communication is hard. It's not easy. The issue is that we all talk all the time. We think we're really good at communicating because we know how to talk. Mm-hmm. But talking and communicating are two very different things. Additionally, storytelling is really hard. And we often think we're better at telling stories than we actually are because we have experienced the story ourselves and it has a lot of meaning to us. So it's emotionally rich and emotionally charged for us, but that does not mean it's going to be emotionally rich or emotionally charged for anyone else unless we work on sculpting the story, crafting the story, rehearsing the story. You ever been to a dinner party where, well, maybe actually this happened to you because I've definitely done this, but maybe someone else, you know, at the dinner party says, oh my God, let me tell you what happened to me today. The most amazing thing. So I'm in the cab and, you know, the driver said, and then he goes on this long story. 10 minutes later, everybody at the table is looking at this person with just a blank stare.
Checked
no
out.
Idea what's happening, just waiting for it to end. And then realize the person who's telling the story realizes, oh, okay, yeah, nobody's listening. Okay, you know what? You had to be there. You just had to be there.
Yeah.
So if you ever tell a story and end with you had to be there, it's a little bit like telling a joke and then explaining the joke afterwards. Explain the joke, it didn't work. Or if you have to tell people you had to be there, then the storytelling didn't work. So just because something happened to us doesn't mean that it's ready to affect other people. So when you think about storytelling, one of the most important aspects of storytelling is influencing how people feel. Very often when people tell stories, they focus on the information that they're sharing. But just the sharing of information doesn't often affect people. It doesn't change the way they think and it doesn't change what they do. If you want to change how somebody thinks, first, you need to change how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
So first we change how they feel, then we change how they think, because they will give us an opportunity to, they will drop their filters. You know, we all know that eating a large pizza and a Big Mac in
is
one
delicious.
Meal is delicious, but not healthy. So we know it's not great for us. And obviously if we do it in moderation, no problem. But let's say, you know, we're not actually really healthy, or let's say we've got some pounds we have to lose, but we still eat the food. We know we shouldn't be doing it, but we still do it. Until we change how we feel about it, we're not going to change what we're doing because we haven't changed what we think about it. So if you keel over tomorrow from a heart attack and live, thankfully, well, you might feel differently about putting that food in your body. And as a result, you may change how you eat. So it always starts with the feeling. So every story has a structure. Now, there are many different storytelling devices, but fundamentally, no matter what structure or device, no matter what type of device you use to tell a story, the structure includes three acts. And this three-act structure was named by Aristotle. So it's been around for a long time. And in fact, he didn't necessarily make up the structure. What he did is he recognized, oh, when people tell stories, this is the structure they use. Act one is exposition. It's the given circumstances. It's the time, the setting, the place. It's what the listener needs to know or understand in order to know or understand what's about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
okay.
If you have too much exposition, you know, right. People are sort of looking at their watches going, come on, I'd like something to happen. Please, let's go, let's go, let's go. Let's move it along. It's sort of like watching a French film. You're like, please, something's going to happen at some point, I hope.
Yeah.
Now, if you don't have enough exposition, then people are confused. And they're thinking, wait, why are they in bed? I thought they were siblings. Now, that also might be a French film, but that's another story. So you do need just enough exposition so that they understand the inciting incident and what's to follow. So the inciting incident is what starts act two. Now, act two is all about the conflict. The inciting incident creates conflict. Now, here's the thing, that conflict creates action. That action creates more conflict. That conflict creates more action.
Mm-hmm.
And that action creates more conflict. Eventually, you'll get to a resolution, which is act three. No, it's very, very simple. It's very actually short and clear. Resolution happens like that. It could be a happy ending, like a Disney movie. Everybody walks off into the sunset. But it could be, you know, like a Quentin Tarantino movie. There's one person, you know, with a bullet hole in their leg, limping away, dragging a bloody sword, leaving a trail of 20 dead bodies behind them. This is why I don't watch Quentin Tarantino films. But that's a resolution. So the resolution can be anything, you know, that it, whatever it is, it doesn't have to be a happy or sad resolution. But the key is, if you're telling a story to change how somebody thinks, there needs to be an insight that the listener has either when they're hearing the story or after they hear the story, either during the story or after the story. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's a moral. Look, the moral of the story is dot, dot, dot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's painfully obvious. Sometimes it's brilliantly obvious. Sometimes it's not immediately obvious, but then you unpack it. Mm-hmm. And so what we suggest people do is, if there's a story that they want to tell because they want to influence how people think and what they do, to write down the story using the three-act structure. What's the exposition? What's the information that they need to know in order to understand what's about to happen in act two? Okay, what's the inciting incident? What creates the initial conflict? All right, once that conflict occurs, what action is taken in the story that creates more conflict? They go through that whole process. You want to find as much conflict as possible and as much action as possible, and you want to raise the stakes so the stakes are high. Because if the stakes are low, it's pedestrian, nobody cares.
Yep.
People love conflict.
Yeah.
This is why the news has become what it is today. You can sell newspapers, you can sell magazines, you can sell news TV programs if they're conflict rich. If it's just the information, nobody cares. Mm-hmm. This is a big problem we have,
But
that's not the problem we're here to solve. I just use it as an example to recognize that what keeps people interested is the conflict. And so no conflict. People go, why do I care about this story? It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I love that you said that about the stakes, because I think you're right in like the conflict and the action is where there's tension. And that's where people should be getting invested. And the resolution, to me, it's like you should be... I guess my question is, are you changing people's, let's say, hearts and minds with the resolution, with the tension, with the stakes, with the conflict, with the action, with all of it? Is there a point where it is, and this is when we get to flip the light switch? Is it a gradual, like, let's pull this out and make them realize? Because I'm wondering if it just has to do with how you want to tell your story and what the story actually is, what that answer is, you know?
Yeah, I think the answer is D, all of the above.
Yeah.
It really depends. The beautiful thing about this particular craft of public speaking, and the sometimes frustrating thing about this craft of public speaking for many people, is that there isn't one way to do it.
Right.
There isn't one formula that works for every single story, for every single person. And if there was, then everybody would tell brilliant stories. And that's just not happening.
No, it is not.
Now, this structure exists in every story. And if this structure, if you look at the story you're telling and you say, well, I don't really have a lot of conflict in the story, it may not be a story. Mm-hmm. It may just be an anecdote. An anecdote is great. We use anecdotes all the time. But an anecdote and a story are two different things. And generally, an anecdote is just, you know, setting a particular picture or an illustration, or just giving people a quick look into something. But a story is designed to change how they feel, which then changes how they think, which then changes what they do.
Yeah. You know, I think if I think back about some of the guests we've had on this show, Michael, that have to me been had compelling cannabis stories about their personal connection to the plant and things like that. They did have high stakes and they did have conflict and a resolution and a journey that got them to where they are today and a perspective on where they want to go tomorrow. And so it's kind of interesting to kind of reacquaint myself with that three act the stage thing again, because the good people do have that. They may not have it structured necessarily in a clean fashion like you do, but they have those key elements versus people that are like, yeah, I had some weed and I got couch lock and that's that, you know, like it's a different, different journey. And our last guest, Nikki Lawley, her story has those elements in there, and she was a great guest. And so it is really fascinating to see the difference in people that follow, whether they knowingly or unknowingly follow that sequence.
And knowingly is so much more important, because imagine if you're going into a lawmaker's office to lobby for legalization, like you're going in with your story to change policy. So get that three act structure down and know where you're going to be going with it to make the biggest impact.
Yeah. There's something else that's worth considering, if I may. Sometimes when people tell a story that, and they have an agenda, they want to change people's minds, especially something like cannabis, I think would fall into this category. If you're going into a lawmaker's office and you want to change their mind about something, sometimes when people structure the story or work on the story, organize the story, and then tell the story, they're trying to get the listener to tell them that they're right.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is, what do people really mean when they say, yeah, yeah, you're right, you're right, you're right? They mean, I'd like to stop having this conversation.
go away now, please.
Yeah, purely dismissive. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So instead of trying to be right, see if you can focus on getting the other person to say, oh, that's right. Because if you go in and sit down and talk to anyone, especially a lawmaker, and you tell them a story that they see themselves in, or somebody they know in, or they see some sort of value, they recognize a value that they have or that they share with you, and they can say, you know what, that's right, then you've got them. But if you're trying to prove that you're right, that means somebody else is wrong. And that means they are wrong. And it's hard for people. It's hard. It's human nature. It's hard for people who feel like they've been told that they're wrong to change their minds and say, yeah, you're right. Very difficult. And it's probably extraordinarily difficult for politicians.
Impossible.
I think that's probably one of the hardest things for them to do, because I've rarely seen a politician ever say, you know what, I was wrong.
Yeah.
I don't get that.
Yeah. Francesca made a great argument in my office 3 weeks ago, and I'm changing my vote in public now. It never happened.
Because what you want them to do is you want it to be their idea.
Yeah. So get them to agree to the point, not with you. It's now the story they can build from there.
It's theirs,
yeah,
as much as it is yours.
They're the character in the story.
Yes, exactly. There's something that they share with you that they got from that story that they can say, yep, that's me too. That's right. So it's the idea that's right. It's not that you, who told me the story, is right. And I now realize I'm wrong. Very, very different.
Such a good distinction.
It is. Michael, I want to get your thoughts on this, on the related, as it relates to this storytelling and connecting and making impact. And it's related to the business side of communication, specifically with how people try to develop and create a brand story. So just as a little background, what we hear a lot of with our customers is, then we talk to them about their products, or let's say they're cultivators, and they'll say, oh, well, this stuff sells itself. It's so good, it sells itself. And that's their brand story. Or it's fire. My edibles are fire. It's, you know, it'll be great. And that is like 100% of their calling card. And so we really try to push them to develop more, you know, better communication strategy, better brand story, better background of what's their why, all those types of things. But from your perspective, Michael, and, you know, I know you've worked with corporate and, you know, individual clients, is it a different recipe that a business should employ as they're trying to tell their brand story in terms of connecting and differentiating, especially in a competitive, crowded, in this world, a state-specific audience?
Well, I think you're right on the money. You hit the nail on the head. Absolutely, I agree that this idea that, well, you know, our stuff is fire is not enough.
No.
Because lots of people have got fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is, when you are selling a product that, even when it's not the best in the world, still works pretty freaking well.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's hard to compete with. So ultimately, any brand story is based on values. But, you know, just throwing some values up against the wall in a conference room, you know, when you have your half day retreat, and saying, well, you know what? We believe in equality. Boom, let's put that one up there. That's one of our values. We believe in
sustainability.
Stability. Boom, throw that up against the wall. So you do that, nobody gives a hoot. The question is, do you actually have something to say? And do you actually care about people? You know, one of our good friends, one of our guest faculty members at Heroic Public Speaking, and somebody we've worked with, I wrote the foreword to his book, Think, Do, Say, is Ron Tight. And one of the things Ron Tight says, and I love it, it's so simple. He says, you either care about people or you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you do care about people, how do you demonstrate that? How do you demonstrate that in a way that is undeniable? How do you make big, strong choices that some people may not like, but the people you are meant to serve will latch onto,
mm-hmm.
they'll resonate with, and they will stick with you through thick and thin. But I don't think you can fake that. And I don't think just through some clever, slick marketing, you can affect that.
It's pretty transparent.
Yeah, it's very transparent.
Especially really now when it's... Oh, sorry, Nick. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, especially now when everybody's... I feel like since 2020, the summer of 2020 in particular, people are hyper aware and vigilant about performative gestures, and especially from businesses.
Yeah, it's like, you know, what was it? Walmart recently that did like a Juneteenth ice cream flavor?
Oh, my God.
Did you hear this?
Tone deaf.
Yeah, they did a Juneteenth ice cream flavor, and then they took it off the day afterwards because, of course, people said, "What are you thinking?"
Yeah.
Right.
You remember, you can go back to that one of the Kendall Jenning people, one of those.
Oh, the Pepsi ad, commercial.
Yeah, the Pepsi commercial.
Yeah.
Where it was bringing cops together with activists. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. So,
you know, jumping on the bandwagon of social causes is not brand building.
Yeah. Well, especially in the industry too, if you think about, they've always been like, we want to have more women in C-suites and this and that. And then 5 years later, it's still not enough. And mm-hmm. so it is, it goes to your point, Michael, of if you're going to say you're going to do it, you damn well better follow through, or else it's going to have a negative connotation on who you are as a brand and what your brand integrity is, let alone the products that you're putting on the shelves.
Yeah.
Brands have to come up with their brand stories. And we all know that deep down, their goal is to generate revenue. They need a good story that makes them good money. And so I think what you said is like, connect with the values that the company has or that the people in the company have is essential. And, you know, Mike and I work with a lot of small farmers, independently owned businesses. And that's, I think, sometimes an easier, sometimes harder to get to with them, because you don't have the soullessness of a corporation to battle. Instead, you have almost like the thinking small, not being able to think about themselves in that light to battle, because they've never seen themselves as the center of the story.
Yeah. Right. So let me see if I can unpack something for you that may be relevant to this particular situation. So
go for it.
So the small grower might have a high level of expertise, and they produce a great product as a result. So they see themselves as experts at producing that product.
Mm-hmm.
The issue today is that experts are a dime a dozen. Now, people who are listening, who see themselves as experts, are going, hey, hold on, buddy. Wait, what did you just say? But if you think about it, you can turn on YouTube and you can get a whole bunch of crap, but you can also learn from thousands of bona fide experts in almost any category imaginable. You want to learn how to make a fiberglass surfboard from scratch? You can go on YouTube and learn how to do that.
Find the expert.
You want to learn how to grow the best plant in the world? You can go on YouTube and someone will teach you how to do that. So experts are everywhere. 30 years ago, totally different story. Because if you were one of the just handful of experts in your particular area, then you were a big deal. But now people have access to experts all over the world. And so relying on your expertise to drive a brand story is generally not going to land. You're because you're living squarely in what we call Expertville. Mm-hmm. Now, the people who tend to actually get the most attention, who can cut through the noise, are the people who move out of Expertville and into Visionary Town.
Yeah,
now, Visionary Town is a much better place to be. The streets are paved with all the product you could possibly ever imagine.
It worked.
Did that work? Okay. But there are fewer people living in Visionary Town. So you have a lot more land to yourself. Because here's what the visionary does. Now, the visionary is a big word. You might not immediately see yourself as a visionary, but it's very simple. All a visionary does is challenge the status quo and offer a new or alternative approach. So if you want to build it's likely that most of the people that are small, either growers or distributors or whatever they're doing
in
the
industry, owners,
if they're in small, you know, if they're not big, massive corporations, most of them went into this because they're disruptors in some way. They don't like the status quo. They want to challenge the status quo. And so if you're going to challenge the status quo, what is your alternative approach? What's the question that you're answering as a business that Google can't?
Yeah, that's
because if Google can answer, then you're just squarely in Expertville. But if Google can't answer it, then you are a thought leader in your space as a visionary, and that's what people connect to.
Yeah, Michael, the first time I heard you say that up at HPS in Lambertville, that was the type of thing that resonated with me and made me really think at night and even, you know, after the event, as far as like, holy shit, I thought Expertville was the place to be. And then it was one of those thoughts that the more it sunk in, the more it really helped to shape kind of how I approach different parts of the business, whether it's this businesses or others, and to help position, you know, our business and in the case of like the sales joint, how to help Francesca position herself, whether it's on the show, whether it's on stage, as that thought leader and as the visionary that's going to challenge and inspire others to want to get on board with what we're doing. And so I think that approach is so important and such a huge distinction.
Well, let's give the listeners some examples. You know, I'm not in your industry, so I don't know who the various players
on the periphery.
Who are some of the vision? What'd you say?
That's it, on the periphery.
But who are some of the visionaries today, and who are some of the original? I mean, I know the term OG.
Yeah.
Some of the OGs may have been the original visionaries.
Yeah.
And who are the visionaries now? So that when your audience thinks about them, they say, "Oh, I see." They challenge the status quo, they offer a new or alternative approach, and they really drive that message again and again and again. So who are those people?
Guys like, I think, legacy growers like John Capaldi out in the Emerald Triangle, that guy's been to prison, did his time, stuck to his guns, had a set vision. I mean, he's kind of like anybody can sing a song into a microphone, but there are a few David Bowies, and that mm-hmm. that's who he is, to at least to me. You know, yeah.
Don't you think as it moves forward in time, also someone like Burner would be in that?
Burner's
no question.
He's changed the cultivation model.
And- no question. He the rules were essentially rewritten, and for more people to have access. So it's to Michael's point, absolutely.
And I think there's going to be in each state different visionaries, because as more states come on board, you're going to see more people take a leadership role in establishing the business, whether that's the social equity part of things, rewriting the laws, or actually developing brands and doing the business. Look at Alex from C1D1. I think he's visionary in the way that he is putting his safety first model, and also
at low cost. Yep.
At low cost, the affordability mm-hmm. of extraction, and sort of demystifying both. He's demystifying and demystifying the idea that CO2 extraction is the only clean form have, because that is what keeps the bar so high and keeps people out of. And he's saying, no, that's not true. You can be clean through ethanol and da 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 da. And if you do safety first, and visionary. And here's how to do it. So yeah, they're definitely out there and getting people to see themselves as visionary. I love the answer a question Google can't is a way to get people to almost like take down the pressure of being brilliant to just being more honest or more authentic in what they have to offer.
Well, and I think this also is a great transition into the last question I know we want to talk to Michael about, which was people on stage. So, you know, having come to Lambertville and see what you help people develop in themselves, I just assumed all public speakers, you know, in any industry would be really, really strong and well-trained, and boy, was I wrong. So, you know, especially in cannabis, and I'm not taking a shot at the industry, but what I am saying is that there's a very low bar to get on stage and deliver information. And so, and it borders on not even being expert, Bill, frankly. And so what we've tried to really do is especially because Francesca has been on the stage quite a bit this year with a lot booked already for next year is to help raise that bar and like do it by example. And so, you know, is there any, you know, for the audience out there, I know we have some people that want to be on stage. Is there, aside from them signing up to coming to HPS, which they should do.
Absolutely.
Do you have any specific tips for how you would give somebody, this is like the cocktail type thing. Somebody comes up, hey, give me three things I should do to be a better speaker.
Since you're the expert.
He's the visionary. He's the visionary. He's not the expert.
which is why I say, no, I will not give you three tips. Because, you know, people like this is people say, what do I do with my hands? What should I do with my hands? I will never tell you what to do with your hands. In a million years. And if you go find a public speaking teacher who tells you what to do with your hands, run. Run as far away as you possibly can. Because if you're focused on things like what to do with your hands, you're entirely externally focused on yourself rather than how you're trying to make the audience feel. And if you are well prepared, you will never need to think about what you're going to do with your hands, because you're so connected and you're so in the moment that what your body is doing is completely organic to how you feel and how you want them to feel. Just like right now, I'm moving my hands around because I'm excited about what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And I'm not thinking about what to do with my hands. That would be ridiculous. So there's no need to do it on stage either. So here's the thing. When you think about it like this for a second, when people are asked to do a presentation, or when they ask to do a presentation, generally, what's the process for preparation? Generally, it looks something like, I got to come up with a title. We come up with a sexy title. It's got to be hot. It's got to be cool. It's got to be, you know, interesting. So people want to come. All right, check. And then they say, "Ooh, I need a slide deck. So let me go to Google. First, I got to open up, you know, PowerPoint or Keynote. And I got to go to, let me find some slides, maybe some funny pictures. I'll put some quotes on the slides, and then
million.
You know, then I'll do some bullet points. Bullet points are always good. Maybe some animation. That's pretty cool. Make it look really good. Focus on that for a while. And once I have that, you know, then I'll just be able to use that in my presentation as my notes, you know, like cue cards. And then I'll just be able to talk to them about all this stuff following along with that presentation.
That's it.
And they actually get to the day of the presentation and they're often really nervous because they're winging it. They really don't know exactly what they're going to be doing. And they generally will go over time, 10, 15 minutes or so, because they are not getting in all the things they wanted to say in the way they wanted to say it. And they don't think that they're actually achieving the goal, and the audience seems distracted or not really connected. So they just keep going until hopefully something will work. And then they walk off stage and they think maybe they did a good job because they had a ton of adrenaline. So they felt like something was happening. But just because you had a lot of adrenaline does not mean the audience felt the same way.
Yeah, they're asleep.
Now, think about anything that you've ever done well in your life. I mean, really well, that you have either at least competency over or maybe even mastery over. Is that something that you just winged? You're like, well, let me just see how it goes. Or is that something that you prepared for and that you trained for and that you spent time on? Of course. No, sometimes what happens is, because, as I said earlier, we talk all the time, we know how to do it, we think we have a level of expertise that makes it easy to talk about what we know, we think that's enough to give a presentation that changes the way people see the world. But it's a false security. If instead you think about it as a craft, well, that might change your perspective. Because when you look at the best performers in the world, whether they're public speakers or actors, you might look at them and say, man, it looks so easy. That they right. they just can do that. You know, they're just
they're natural. Yeah.
Natural. Yeah. Wow. Holy cow. It's so easy for them. It is, because they have done an enormous amount of prep work. Their process for developing that speech was dramatically different than this process that I just outlined, which is the typical process that most people use. So for example, when you start working on a speech, you don't just start writing the speech. You start with an ideation phase, and then a content development phase, and then a script writing phase. And then you just have a rehearsal ready draft.
Right.
And then you put together a rehearsal schedule. And you start working through that script, through that rehearsal schedule, so that you know that material so well that you don't need to think about it when you're on stage, such that it comes to you organically in the moment as if it's the first time you've ever done it, even though you know exactly what you're going to do.
Right.
And the way that you judge your success as a performer is not by whether or not the audience leaps to their feet and gives you a standing ovation or tells you you're incredible. Instead, you judge it by, did I do exactly what I planned on doing? Did I do what I planned on doing? If you had no plan, then you can't actually do what you planned on doing. You had no plan.
That's interesting. What a great measure that does not allow you to skirt the system.
Yep. And it takes the focus off of seeking approval.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the hardest things about speaking for many people is the fear of rejection. You know, we're afraid people are going to tell us that we don't know what we're talking about, or that we're boring, and they're going to reject us and our ideas. And that's more likely to happen if you're unprepared. But even so, if your focus is on the need for approval, then your work and your focus is on yourself as opposed to the audience. Mm-hmm. So the two best ways of reducing stage fright or anxiety around performing, number one, know what you're going to do before you do it. So be prepared. Anytime you want to do something for the first time, if you prepared for it, you'll be less nervous than if you didn't prepare for it. And number two, take the focus off yourself. Take the focus off, how do I look? How do I sound? Are people going to like me? Take the focus off the need for approval and focus entirely on influencing how they feel, how they think, and what they do.
There it is.
So your drive, your fight is for them, creating a transformational experience for them. It's not about you. It's never been about you. It's always about the speech that you give in service of that audience. And if they don't love every element of that speech, no problem. It's not that they don't like you. There's nothing wrong with you. It means that element of the product, which is the speech, just needs more work.
Yeah, I like the whole, it's not about you, it's never been about you. And I feel like that should be on the back of your HPS t-shirt. That'd
be good. Nice. No, that makes me think, I know we're coming up against a time crunch with Michael. And again, we're grateful for your time. Michael is a former literature teacher, drama teacher here. I was hanging on every word when you were talking about your Aristotelian narrative structure and stuff. I have to tell you this, you need to be proud. There's proof in the pudding. When Francesca does speak, it something happens in that room. People come back to our booth. And I don't see people follow up and engage like that. So that's a testament to the training that Mike and Francesca received under you and Amy up at HPS. So we know you're doing great work. And since we are a show that we tell our audience what to do with their hands all the time, if they get their hands on a keyboard, how do they find you and HPS? Plug away.
You are clever. Very well done, Nick.
I wonder where that was going.
He's the best.
Yeah, we're really easy to find. HeroicPublicSpeaking.com. HeroicPublicSpeaking.com. Now, here's the thing, Nick. Heroic Public Speaking is primarily a referral-only organization.
Gotcha.
So we save 5% of the seats in our events for people who don't have a referral. But once we talk to them, we know that it's the right place for them and we can help them achieve their goals. But if you do want to come and do some work with us, just contact Mike or Francesca and they can make the referral directly to us. We'd be happy to have you at HBS if you come with a referral through Mike or Francesca. Now, because we're a referral only organization, we do a 2-day event that we don't charge for. It's a very comprehensive, very complete transformational event that we call Heroic Public Speaking Core. And we ask people to put down a deposit that we give them back as soon as they walk in the door, because of course, you know, we got to make sure that they're actually going to show up. And we always have more demand for those than we have seats, but we can do it totally free because everybody comes through from a referral. And then usually 65 to 85% of the people who come want to continue to do work with us. It's one of the things that I think is unique. And I'm just addressing this a bit because I think it's going to be relevant for a lot of the people who are listening. What we do is very unique. And even though we're professional communicators, it's very hard to really understand what we do without experiencing it.
Yes.
Agreed.
Totally agree.
Because if you've never experienced anything like it, just talking about it is not necessarily going to demonstrate.
Yep. Sure.
You know, what it actually is. So we have a bit of a telling problem. So the answer to a telling problem is a showing solution. So that's why we do these events for free, but by referral only.
Got it.
Okay. So for those folks who are listening, who do something that really is quite unique, you have probably a telling problem. So how do you create a model where you can use a showing solution to that telling problem?
We'll be nice. Clipping and quoting that for sure.
That's a new one too. I didn't hear that during my stay up there. Oh, the showing and telling part. That's nice. I like it.
Mike, well, Francesca, my person.
Just special for your podcast.
Well, we have something special for you too.
All right. Francesca, all right. Fire away.
Well, we like to challenge all of our, well, the guests that we know we can challenge, and ourselves with a little would you rather at the end of our interviews. So one last question for you, Michael Port, is would you rather be able to read somebody's mind or be able to control their dreams? The dreams that they have when they sleep. Read their mind.
Absolutely.
All right.
Without hesitation.
Really?
Yes.
Not into the subtle influence.
Such a nefarious. No.
But let me tell you about this very strange dream I had last night.
I'm reading your mind right now. I already know what you're going to say.
Oh, good. Then I won't mention it. I'll, since you already know, you can tell Nick and Francesca later.
Mike, what would you do?
Was the dream? Would no, you I want to hear it? This dream.
Oh, yeah. I do want to hear the
What's
dream.
The dream?
Oh, I thought it was just so good. We leave it on that note. Oh,
let's do it. Okay. I think so, too. Right.
Cliffhanger.
So if I'm in that scenario, I am going with... So my initial knee jerk was reading minds, but then I'm scared to death about what I'm going to find out. Like, wow, that's what they really think. Like, so that could be really dangerous too. So, but I think I'm going to stick with read your mind.
Yeah.
Ooh, all right.
I'm just intrigued by the nefarious line of questioning here. She's just, she's invading the subconscious yeah. regardless.
Nick, you're screwed.
I know. I'm going to go with the mind reading as well, not to just keep up the same theme, but then I could just start conversations with how dare you? And that would be great. And that would be a dream for me. Frank, what do you got?
Wow. I think I'm going to have to go with controlled dreams. Ooh. I think I could become a little, I think it'd be selfish if you could read people's minds and what they're thinking. Cause then you just turn any conversation and that socially, I think could be very destructive. So if I can control.
Isn't that the exact point?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
you're selfish.
I think
Frank, you're a better person than all of us.
Yeah, I did. Oh, no. No question about it.
Yeah, he is.
He should be on this podcast.
doesn't no, behind the camera.
Integrity.
Doesn't want to be the social.
Francesca, status. What's your answer on this one? I think I know.
I would definitely control dreams. Yeah, I'm far too anxious to read anybody's mind. I already think I can, and it's terrible. So I just want to control dreams. I'll subtly influence and let you come to the decisions yourselves because it came to you in a dream.
Good point.
There it is.
There it is.
Guys, this has been an absolute blast. And on behalf of Mike, Francesca, and Frank and myself, Michael, as a former teacher, you always remember the powerful, memorable, engaging teachers, and you've certainly left a tremendous impact on our friends and our audience today as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
My pleasure. I was looking forward to this all week.
All right.
So
great to hear. All right, guys, this has been a blast. Mr. Michael Port of Heroic Public Speaking has been our guest today on the Infused Show. We're going to see you on the next episode right here in Delahoo, Delawat, Delaware. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hey friends, I'm Brannon.
And I'm Saba.
And we are your host of the Cannabis Hangout Podcast, an educational platform to connect with the cannabis community and share personal stories while breaking the stigma of marijuana.
Join us every Sunday at 7 p.m. to gain valuable insight with different perspectives from industry leaders, growers, and medical marijuana patients.
This is a place to learn so much from different angles in the cannabis industry. So tune in while we break it all down.